There's hope and there's blind faith in the face of all the evidence. What are you going to do to make him love us? Sign him up to a string quartet?
They entered the transporter room. Picard gave a bark of laughter. Who knows? An encounter with Beethoven might be the making of the man.
It might do something to him. Geez, though, this might backfire. He might make us listen to Romulan indeterminate polyphony.
Raffi, he said with some amusement, you never cease to amaze me. What on earth is Romulan indeterminate polyphony?
You really want to know?
Of course I want to know.
It's singing, yes? Voices unaccompanied?
That part, he said, I understood. How about the indeterminacy?
They don't know what the other people are singing.
There was a pause. Picard glanced at Lieutenant Shriv Thakothrek on duty by the transporter controls. The Andorian shook his head.
Don't look at me.
You're not telling me the truth, are you, Commander?
J.L., I swear on my mother's life that every word of this is true. They are given a starting note, a musical key, and a tempo. The performers are in separate rooms. The audience sits in a gallery above and looks down on them. They're given the cue to start, and off they go.
Picard contemplated this. He had not considered how the Romulan principle of secrecy might play out in their art.
What a fascinating idea.
How does it sound?
How do you think it sounds? It sounds fucking awful.
Behind them, the Kothrek stifled a laugh.
Then let us by all means prevent any move toward establishing a Romulan glee club, said Picard gravely, in lieu of which I shall endeavor to kill him with kindness.
He gave the nod to Thakothrek.
There are quicker ways, said Raffi, to kill a Tal Shiar agent.
By luck, rather than design, she finished speaking exactly as Tajuth materialized. He was tall and spare, with distinct cranial ridges.
A northerner, murmured Raffi.
Is that significant? Asked Picard.
They can be chippy, said Raffi.
Picard stepped forward.
Jolan True, he said. We are very glad to welcome you on board, Lieutenant Tajuth. We look forward to working with you.
He turned to introduce Raffi.
This is my first officer, Lieutenant Commander Raffi Musica.
Hi, said Raffi with a touch of acid.
Tajuth looked at them both down his long nose. Then he looked around the transporter bay. He sighed as if he didn't want him to be there either.
It has been a long journey, he said. If I could see my quarters, and then we'll discuss the next mission.
Of course, said Picard, and gestured to Tajuth to follow him. Raffi, following behind, muttered,
Sounds fucking awful.
Federation Council, Paris, Earth. Kirsten Clancy knew that many of her colleagues resented the round of functions and drinks parties that seemed to clutter one's diary once you were promoted past a certain point. She did not mind. Not because she particularly enjoyed small talk, although she did not find it difficult, and she threw herself into the task with the same dedication that she brought to every aspect of her work. She knew how much crucial information could be learned during the course of these events. Drinks flowed, and tongues loosened, and people were trying to impress everyone, hinting at sources of information to which others did not have access, anxious to make themselves seem close to power. Clancy, moving around these spaces in her dress uniform, was someone looking to be cultivated. She listened to everything and drank synthetic sparkling wine. She was an expert in making people believe they'd had a full and frank exchange of views, when mostly she had learned a great deal and they had been told very little in return. This function, an annual reception for newly elected members of the Federation Council, was a regular fixture in Clancy's diary. This year's new counselors were next year's committee chairs or policy leaders or one day even president. Clancy wanted to know who or what was heading her way. She had observed over the years that they generally fell into one of two categories, those who were stunned into silence and those intent on making a great deal of noise. The latter Clancy looked out for. They generally caused her some small trouble at some point along the line. This year, she was on the lookout for someone very specific. She had heard of Olivia Quest, the new junior council member for Estolin, before even entering the room. Estolin was a small world close to the neutral zone, and Quest was a descendant of one of the original settler families. She had been the chief executive officer of that family's large-scale agricultural operations on Estolin and its moons. An engineer by training, with a specialty in terraforming, she was reputed to be extremely smart, not to mention frustrated by the lack of influence that such small worlds had on Federation policy. She had run on a platform of setting up a committee to scrutinize the Romulan relief mission, to which, Quest had argued during her campaign, too many resources were being allocated. Jean-Luc Picard's remarkable decision to take Romulan settlers into Federation space had proven a godsend for Quest. Her face had hardly been off the newscasts. "Is this policy now? Will all the worlds along the border be asked to take Romulan settlers? Will the point come where we will be required to take them? Our hearts go out to these people in need, but surely there are questions to be asked about whether this is the best solution. The border is destabilized. Floods of refugees. Do we have the ability to help them properly? Do we have the right? Maybe we should be considering whether Romulan space is better for Romulans." You could hear the dog whistle a click off, Clancy thought sourly. Nevertheless, these interviews, which gathered pace in the last 10 days of her campaign, had propelled Quest into office. In her victory speech, she had promised to come to the council to ask serious questions about the mission. "We owe it to ourselves and to the Romulans, too." Several counselors from other worlds along the border had already signaled their interest in serving on a scrutiny commission beside Quest.
"We need new blood like this," one said. "Shake us up. Stop us doing business as usual. Ask the right sorts of questions."
The function room was packed. Bright lights glinted off decorations from countless worlds. The babble and chatter of dozens of conversations filled the space. Still, there was a noticeable ripple when Quest arrived. Clancy, talking to an aide from Trill, had positioned herself carefully to be able to watch the entrance and saw Quest enter the room. She stood for a moment, the doorway forming an arch around her, surveying the gathering. Everyone turned to look. She was tall, rather masculine in feature, her jaw slightly square. Her white blonde hair, very straight and fine, came down to her ears. Her eyes, deep set, were a bright and piercing blue. She was wearing a silver dress which looked stunning. She knew exactly how much impact she was having. She let everyone look at her, and then she swept into the room where a senior counselor from Corridan and a high-ranking official from the Federation Science Bureau gathered her up and started introducing her to key players. The captain, courteously disentangling herself from the young Trill, started to circulate around the room. As she moved, she caught snatches of conversation.
"Real questions about what this means for worlds on the border. My wife's cousin left his post at Utopia Planitia, you know. Couldn't get the resources he needed for his work. Gotta wonder about the impact on the defensive capabilities of new ships if all we're doing now is making damn ferries. I don't want this to sound bad, but maybe Romulan space really is best for Romulans."
Clancy, hearing all this, taking the temperature of the room, thought, "Next time you come up with a smart idea, Jean-Luc Picard, you might want to run it past command first." A waiter offered her some canapés. She said, "No, thanks. I'm good." At the sound of her voice, Quest turned and looked at her. Her eyes were bright, intelligent, amused, and calculating. She nodded at Clancy. She plainly knew exactly who she was, and then turned back to her conversation. They spoke only once, in passing, much later in the evening, when Quest was on her way out, in the company of several other more senior counselors, all from worlds close to the neutral zone. Nodding in greeting as she passed, Quest said,
"Captain Clancy, I'm sorry we didn't get a chance to talk. I look forward to making your acquaintance another time."
"This one," thought Clancy, watching her leave in a shimmer of silver, "is trouble." Verity.
"How is your new cultural liaison officer settling in?"
"Fine," said Picard. "He and Raffi have only come to blows once."
Seeing Bordson's face, he said,
"I'm joking, Victor. But Raffi has good reason not to trust the Tal Shiar, as do we all."
"We have no evidence that Tajuth is Tal Shiar."
"If we had evidence," said Picard, "he would not be a particularly effective member of the organization. But we shall win him over. I shall play good cop. Raffi can be bad cop."
"Where on earth did you find that extraordinary expression?"
"A detective novel from 20th century Earth. As yet, Tajuth's presence has caused no difficulties."
"Well, as long as it keeps the Romulans happy. But we have another set of people who are asking questions, Jean-Luc, and whose concerns must be assuaged."
"There are always people like that. Must we bother with them?"
"Since they are elected members of the Federation Council, I'm afraid we must."
"What was it that Churchill said about democracy?" said Picard dryly.
"Your knowledge is wider than mine, Jean-Luc."
"He said it was the worst form of government, except for all those other forms that have been tried. Who on the council is asking questions?"
"Counselor Olivia Quest."
Picard searched his considerable personal knowledge and said,
"I've never heard of her."
"She represents Estadon,
a planet very close to the neutral zone. She is naturally concerned about the ramifications of your recent decision and how it could affect her world."
"That seems reasonable enough."
"And as a junior counselor, she will be seeking re-election in 4 years.
"Ah," said Picard. "Now we get to the heart of it."
"She's a young woman in a hurry, and she's keeping herself very busy. She's persuaded the council to set up an oversight committee for the relief mission. She's heading it, of course."
"Who else is involved?" Picard asked.
Bordson immediately sent over the list, which Picard read through with a sinking heart.
"Is everyone here suspicious of Romulans in some way?"
"There are good historical reasons for that, Jean-Luc."
"We are not living in the past. We are living in an unprecedented present."
"Nevertheless, these are elected officials. Their opinion carries weight, and public scrutiny of how our resources are being used is only appropriate."
Bordson sighed.
"I wish you were more sensitive to the political ramifications of your decisions, Jean-Luc. This mission will fail without political will behind it."
Picard frowned. The careers and jockeying of some minor functionaries were as nothing compared to the number of lives they were trying to save. He said,
"What can I do to help, Victor?"
"A few high-profile successes wouldn't do any harm."
"We are successful all the time. The situation on Arnath and again on Sithu, these might attract attention, but the real work of this mission goes on quietly. Is Quest aware how many people we have already successfully relocated? Has she taken the time to visit some of the towns we have helped to build, or to speak to some of the people whom we have saved? Has she taken the time to visit the mission headquarters there on Earth? Spoken to Crystal Bowie about the logistical work in which she and her team are engaged? Or to Cotton on Starbase 32 about coordinating the fleet? Or visited Mars or the Daystrom Institute and asked questions about the technological innovation being undertaken?"
"Sending her to Mars might not be a bad idea," said Bordson. "Technological innovation in ship design is something she should be able to understand. A concrete ancillary benefit from all this."
"We are not undertaking this mission to push forward ship design," said Picard.
"You're not," said Bordson, "and I'm not. But other people are not as selfless as you and I."
Picard shook his head.
Saving lives should be enough.
Romulan lives, said Bordson.
I seem to hear that a great deal these days. It makes no difference to me.
Unfortunately, to some people it does.
I'm glad you're the one having to speak to them, Victor. I'm not sure I would be able to restrain myself.
Kirsten Clancy will handle Quest and her committee, Jean-Luc. But they exist, and their demands and their concerns are real, and could well have an impact on this mission. Give me a big win that I can take back to them. Politicians are simple folk. Let us give them a story that they can easily understand.
Bordson closed the channel. Easy to understand, thought Picard.
But the fact was that some tasks, some missions, were complicated. They required complex solutions.
There was no conjuring trick he could perform to solve this crisis, no spell that he could cast that would spirit their problems away. The true magic of this mission lay in its daily grind, moving supplies and people around, attention to detail, forward planning, and careful logistical work. Such things were not suited to easy stories and headlines. That did not make them any less heroic in Picard's eyes. Quite the opposite. The combined action of many people, the steady, patient, and dedicated work, that, he thought, was the real heroism. Later, when he was bringing Raffi up to speed on the conversation, he said, "Bordson wants a big win."
"Geez," Raffi replied, "don't we all?"
Romulan Astrophysical Academy, Romulus. Even for a Romulan, Nokim Vritet was a solitary man. Brought up in a family that, while well-connected, was nevertheless riven by the feuds and quarrels of multiple factions, he had decided at a very young age that the best way to rise above it all was to look up and up at the night sky. At the age of 6, he petitioned so fiercely for a telescope that his parents, used to a silent and somewhat biddable child, immediately supplied one. He proceeded to teach himself about the stars, and, having learned that this combination of extended periods of silence, punctuated by sudden and clear demands, was an effective tactic to get what he wanted, he would occasionally surface to make clear and specific requests for extra tuition, for further equipment, for introductions to relevant people. His family, who were amused, if baffled, indulged these demands. At 16, Vritet presented his first paper. At 21, he completed doctoral studies and took up a research post at the Astrophysical Academy. His entire goal was to be left alone to look at his beloved stars, those silent comrades who made no demands, who moved at their own pace, who spoke of a larger pattern behind the random noise that seemed to be the stock in trade of the people around him. Nokim Vritet was therefore entirely unprepared for his area of study to become the most hotly contested field in galactic politics. He worked quietly and unobtrusively. He was entirely ignorant, for example, that for over a year now, all of his incoming and outgoing communications had been monitored, intercepted, censored, and some deleted. He had no idea that the two new colleagues in the office next door were Tal Shiar, sent specifically to observe him. He was unaware that he had been invited to a symposium on Earth, and that Dr. Amal Safadi, whose work he admired, had sent him messages. He certainly did not know about her paper and its contents. But numbers do not lie, and nature cannot be fooled, and it was therefore only a matter of time before a man as meticulous as Vritet replicated Safadi's results. He was sitting at his desk in his office, which was situated in a rather pokey corner of the academy and had been his private sanctum for nearly 2 decades. He had made the most of the space available. Visitors to Vritet's office had to negotiate 2 sliding doors that shifted about in a complex fashion, such that one had to be open a very precise amount before the other was unlocked. This, as well as the abstruse nature of his research, meant that he rarely had visitors. This was what he preferred.
his long-suffering doctoral student, 7 years into her project with no end in sight, had given up trying to see Vritet face to face. In fact, she was in the process of shifting herself and her work over to the astronomical unit on Utux. She would then complete her thesis in 7 months and, not incidentally, save her own life by getting away from the Romulan homeworld so early. It would be almost a year before Vritet would even notice she was gone. But this morning, even Nokim Vritet realized that the wider world was soon going to be knocking on his door. He had noticed the irregular readings from the Romulan sun toward the end of the previous year, and, comparing these with data published by other researchers, had concluded that they were looking at sunspot activity that, while at the upper end of the range, was nevertheless within normal parameters. Still, the phenomenon interested him, and he began compiling his own data set, acquired from several probes upon which he had, as a teenager, and thanks to a wealthy and influential uncle with business interests in this area who had a fondness for the family eccentric, quietly installed a number of sensors. These had, over the years, privately supplied him with all manner of interesting information. The source of his data was, therefore, not controlled by the government, and, unknown to him, much closer to the readings that Dr. Safadi had taken. He had been compiling the data for a week or two now, modeling the effects of the supernova. This morning, he was confronted with the results. The supernova, that global disaster that everyone was vaguely worrying about, was coming much sooner than anyone had thought. All of it. The changes in climate, and the ultimate end. Even a man as isolated as Vritet, one who had not yet connected the rising cost of fresh food on Romulus with the strain on infrastructure that the relocation effort was causing, immediately understood the ramifications of his results. His first reaction, as he watched the rings fan out quicker than ever before, taking in more and more worlds, was a cold sense of shock that almost sent him into panic. His second reaction, for someone so solitary he remained at heart a scientist, was to want some independent verification of his figures. His third reaction was to realize with dismay that he would have to go and speak to someone else. He rose from his chair, picked up his handheld device, and went in search of his direct superior, academician Nurius, the director of the academy. Nurius was a big, bluff man whom Vritet sometimes suspected of being more politician than scientist. In the past, he had deplored this. It might come in useful now.
"Well," said Nurius, "a most startling analysis, Nokim."
"I'm extremely worried about it," said Vritet. "Has the Federation done any work on this? There are a few people on Earth who I know have an interest in this field. There's Amal Safadi." He went on to list a handful of people, which Nurius noted down to pass on to the Tal Shiar to add to any communications blacklist.
"Federation research is hard to come by, of course," said Nurius. "They are not exactly friendly."
Vritet, who found it easier to believe propaganda rather than waste valuable time deciding for himself, nodded. "Yes, yes, very sad. Still, I do think that these figures are sufficiently alarming. We should try to get some independent verification."
"Let me send this on," said Nurius. "I'll pass on your request for anything that the Federation might deign to make available to us."
He stood up, and so Vritet did the same.
"In the meantime, I'd say get back to work and don't worry."
Nurius laughed and maneuvered the other man out of the door. "But if the star is going to Nova this quickly, the evacuation of Romulus should already be well underway."
"And I'm sure that if that was the case, the authorities would already know. As you say, there would be a plan underway for our evacuation, wouldn't there? But don't worry, Nokim. I'll pass this upward. Our superiors will have everything in hand. Our leaders wouldn't cut and run and leave us all to die now, would they?"
Vritet left and went back to his office. He tried to turn his attention to his current project, but he couldn't get those concentric rings out of his mind. Mid-afternoon, he received a message from Nurius sending him a report plastered in Federation and Starfleet logos and Amal Safadi's name, which, on reading, told him that Federation figures agreed not with his new data, but with the previously accepted model that put the blast range at 9.7 light-years and the pace of the Nova at the original rate. He was puzzled, but he respected Safadi and the people at Cambridge, and so he decided that he had made a mistake. It was hard sometimes working alone, like wandering through a maze where you frequently went down the wrong path and then had to go right back to the beginning. He had wandered many such mazes on the various family estates over the years. Sometimes he still had nightmares about them. He considered whether his research student might be able to help, and then thought that bringing her up to speed would be too much distraction. Instead, he decided to get a new set of readings and run the model again, from a fresh data set. In the meantime, he would try to do what Nurius had suggested and put the whole thing out of his mind. But whenever he closed his eyes, he saw Romulus consumed, and he saw all the people left behind. After Vitet left his office, Nurius was extremely busy. He went to speak to the two Tal Shiar agents who had been installed on Vitet's corridors some months back. They examined Vitet's model with interest and sent Nurius a report that they told him was written by Dr. Safadi at the Cambridge Institute of Astronomy on Earth, which had coincidentally arrived earlier that morning, and which showed that Vitet was certainly mistaken. Nurius had no reason to ignore their request to pass the report on to Vitet. And once he had done that, he put in a request for a transfer to a research institute on a remote world halfway across the quadrant where his daughter had settled some years ago. Nurius, at least, did not doubt Vitet's genius and made haste to be gone from Romulus by the end of the year. He survived long enough to retire in some comfort until a bite from a hunting wound went septic. Problems with maintaining supply lines to his new home meant that the necessary drugs were not available, and he died within days, a secondary victim of the times in which he lived. But at least he escaped Romulus. Seven.
Admiral's log. It is a scant 6 weeks since I first heard the name Olivia Quest, and now it seems to be everywhere. I believe this is not simply a matter of perception. The Counselor has wasted no time since her election, and, remarkably some would say for a politician, has gotten to work immediately in keeping her chief campaign promise to set up a committee to scrutinize the relief mission. A number of other councillors, not all of whom represent worlds close to the neutral zone, have put their support behind her, and as a result, the committee, which comprises half a dozen councillors, is now well established. My office at Starfleet Command has been approached for full access to files and staff. This is a not inconsiderable burden for my already very busy teams, who now increasingly find themselves facing sudden requests for information or to attend interviews with the committee. I do resent these incursions on their time when we are overstretched and on what seems, from this distance, to be meddling on Quest's part. We have a clear and difficult task to perform, one of an unprecedented nature, and naturally mistakes are likely to be made. Mistakes are, after all, how we learn. The mission is not served and the staff not rewarded for their Herculean efforts by a sense that a group of politicians are watching over their shoulders, eager to interpret any misstep as evidence that the mission is out of hand. Curious about Quest, I asked Raffi to assemble her election speeches into a compilation for me to see. I confess I found these concerning viewing. The phrase, "Romulan space is better for Romulans," appeared with depressing regularity, and I understand from Raffi that it has gained some considerable currency since, not only within political circles, from people who should know better, but among the general population. I find sentiments such as these narrow and even reprehensible. The best place for any person is a place where they can live in peace.
I am not personally inclined to indulge Counselor Quest, but, nevertheless, at the request of Victor Bordson, I have been reflecting upon where this mission has hitherto been most successful, so that representatives from the Federation Council might see that the work we do is achieving measurable results. As ever, I am able to rely on Commander LaForge to be able to demonstrate excellence and achievement, and I have therefore advised that Counselor Quest and her colleagues begin by visiting the shipyards at Utopia Planitia to see the scale of the operation there, and the success that Commanders LaForge and Mackenzie have had in implementing their plans for upscaling production. My sense is that technological breakthroughs such as these are a concrete and straightforward way in which people can see that the Federation is gaining benefits from this mission. Admiral Bordson advises me that while technological achievements are certain to impress Quest, others on the committee will be looking at the relief effort to see how the mission fares. We have many achievements to report. Tens of thousands of Romulans ferried from one world within the Empire to another. But naturally, Bordson is keen to demonstrate that my gamble of settling Romulans in Federation space can work. After close consultation with Rafi and Coley, and I must admit our resident Romulan, Lieutenant Tajuth, I am taking our core of 10 ships, including the Verity, to Inxtus, a world close to the neutral zone, whose inhabitants are to be relocated to Federation space. The people on the Federation world of Vashti, in the Kiris sector, have offered to welcome these refugees and have been preparing facilities for them. My hope is that this mission will provide us with the success story we need to address the concerns being raised by the committee, and, not incidentally, continue to justify the policy of moving Romulans into Federation territory. I do not underestimate the challenges of introducing a Romulan population into Federation colonies, but I believe that with dedication and intelligence and the appropriate support, these situations can be managed in such a way as to allow the settlers to flourish on their new worlds. Hostility between Federation citizens and Romulans is understandable. Centuries of mistrust lie between us, and the Romulan habit of secrecy is so deeply ingrained that one might almost call it an instinct. But I remain optimistic that somewhere within Romulan space there are people who believe that this mission can succeed in its wider goal of bringing about friendship and understanding between our two great civilizations. Utopia Planitia Shipyards, Mars. Olivia Quest knew that she was ruffling feathers, and frankly, she didn't give a damn. She was intelligent and ambitious, but she was also the product of a small and easily overlooked world. Her ambition had, early on, outstripped what she could do with her family's agricultural holdings. A brief period studying on Earth for a doctorate in xeno-agronomy had opened her eyes to the wider Federation of which Estelin was a member. As the years passed, she became increasingly and deeply frustrated with the structural imbalances she saw in the Federation. For a society that prided itself on its inclusiveness and equality, there was, she knew, an unstated hierarchy at work. The founding worlds, Vulcan, Earth, Andor, Tellar, all had considerable sway. Quest understood that they had the weight of history behind them, not to mention size of population, but these facts surely should not be allowed to give them such influence over the destiny of other worlds. Yet, what could these smaller worlds do? The Big Four had the informal means by which they brought members into the Federation, making the new blood beholden to them. How could a small world like hers combat this? Quest had not been surprised during her first months as a Federation counselor to learn how many others from small worlds shared her opinion. During private conversations in quiet corners at social functions or in confidences exchanged at dinner parties, person after person from world after world told her of their frustrations at how the Big Four pushed through policy, how lip service was paid to them, but that their concerns were often passed over and forgotten when one of the founding worlds had a more important concern.
Take this Romulan relief mission. That told you everything you wanted to know. Many of the small worlds along the neutral zone were concerned by the sudden influx of Romulans. Some were frankly terrified that they would find themselves pressured into accepting considerable numbers of refugees among communities who could never love a Romulan. What would this mean for the stability of their worlds? Where had the promised infrastructure projects gone? Why were the replicators and archiprinters busy producing homes for Romulans? The spaceport on Nitis was in desperate need of renovation, and the promised transporter links between the two hemispheres of Brk were going unbuilt. Hadn't there been a plan to terraform another 3 of Talate's 15 moons? What had happened there? Sometimes it seemed to these small worlds that the big powers felt they had more in common with Romulus than with the people of their own federation. This was not right. Many were saying this, more and more openly. This was unjust. Quest was here to do something about it, and she found that among the many tiny worlds that comprised the Federation, she had allies. She was here not simply to ask questions. She was here to get answers. The committee that she had promised to establish had taken off even more rapidly than she could have hoped. She had expected stonewalling, but the head honchos at Starfleet Command had proven surprisingly willing to give her access. She had spent a week on Earth following Commander Bowie and her helpful shadow, Lieutenant Call. Other senior players in the Romulan mission had also been very useful. T'Katan sent her such detailed and meticulous overviews of the fleet's schedules that she almost suspected him of trying to overload her with data. But above all, Quest longed to bring the public face of the whole mission, Admiral Picard, in front of her committee. Imagine the vids. The casts would be delighted with her. But she knew that this would have to wait until she had significantly more political capital. Picard was much admired, much respected. She would look like she was overreaching. She might look as if she had become overly self-satisfied. Who was she, after all? A junior counselor from a small farming world on the border. It could wait. In the meantime, her inquiries were taking her to Mars. Quest had multiple degrees in engineering and was experienced in the kind of targeted terraforming projects that made her world viable. She was therefore confident when interviewing engineers and scientists. She would not be fazed. Sometimes they tried to blind politicians with technical language, but this wasn't going to work with her. And, in all honesty, she was excited to see the shipyards at Utopia Planitia. She was, she knew, a product of her civilization. She was Federation trained. She believed in the transforming potential of science and technology. She believed that groups of diverse people could band together to achieve great things. But she was sick of not having her chance to be on the inside, making policy, deciding what projects were pushed through. Now was her chance. She believed it was her duty, too. She was here to serve her world, and those worlds that shared her sense of grievance and dispossession, and therefore give them back their voice. Arriving on Mars, she was greeted by the project leads, Commander Geordi LaForge and Commander Estella McKenzie. They began the tour of the groundside facilities. Quest was, quite simply, stunned by the scale of what she saw. She was not pleased. "So far, most of our work has been refitting existing ships," said LaForge, as he walked her through one of the vast hangars where pieces of hulls were being tested. "But ultimately, the intent is to produce a fleet of purpose-built ships." "What sort of numbers are we talking about?" said Quest. "Between 1,500 and 2,000 ships over the next year. Eventually, 10,000 ships will be built." Quest stopped dead in her tracks. Her mouth fell open. Her homeworld had 15 decent-sized but increasingly elderly vessels at its disposal. "All this," she thought, "for Romulans. Where are our new ships? What are we getting from this?" LaForge, mistaking the nature of her surprise, grinned and said, "Pretty impressive, huh?
I am amazed, Quest said, at how quickly you have been able to get this operation up and running. Any trouble getting the resources?
Well, it's been a major task, obviously, said LaForge, but Starfleet has always come through.
Has it? Quest said dryly. How good it was to have friends in high places.
The biggest worry, said Mackenzie, has been the workforce, making sure we have enough labor to get the work done.
So, we had to get creative, LaForge offered.
Oh, yes, said Quest. I've been hearing a lot about this. Advances in robotics, I understand.
LaForge and Mackenzie shared a look of great pride and contentment.
More than that, said Mackenzie. Come over here, Counselor.
Quest followed the engineers to a gallery that overlooked a long production line. She watched a dozen people moving around. She had seen many production lines, watched sorting lines on her family's large farms looking for efficiencies in time and motion, and she grasped immediately that something was different here. After a moment, she realized exactly what it was. It was the figures. Not the speed of their movement, although that was impressive enough, but their uniformity.
Are these?
The Daystrom A500, said LaForge proudly. The most advanced synthetic yet created. Well, he said, they're not data. Quest stared down at the machines that she had taken for living beings.
These are remarkable.
Aren't they?
They're not.
She hesitated over the word.
Sentient?
What? LaForge quickly disabused her of that idea. Oh, no, no. Data was unique in that respect. You should go and see Bruce Maddox at the Daystrom Institute. See the synth production facilities there.
I will. I shall.
Quest pulled her gaze away, remembered why she was there. I have to ask again, though, this is the point of my inquiry after all, isn't this all a huge drain on resources? From other projects, I mean? Haven't various projects here on Mars been put on hold? Some even canceled? LaForge said, we all knew when we signed up for this mission that a lot of things would have to be put on hold. But it's the right choice.
It must be hard, though, to have your research put on the back burner while everything shifts over to this.
How did people here respond to this change in priorities? She did not miss them exchanging a look.
Engineers are practical people, said Mackenzie. There's no point coming up with innovative materials for deep space exploration vessels if deep space exploration is a secondary concern right now. We all like to see our work in use.
Well, you raise an important point there, Commander, Quest said. Plenty of people have been asking how much of Starfleet's core mission has to stop in order to support this work, and whether it's right for such a large proportion of Federation resources to be poured into...
She let the end of her sentence hang in the air. Helping Romulans? Said LaForge. He was frowning.
We've been enemies a long time, said Quest. Is it wise to throw away an advantage?
I guess compassion often looks foolish, said LaForge. I know I, for one, don't mind looking foolish now and then. He gave a disarming laugh. I guess I'm old-fashioned in that way.
I'm not talking about leaving them to die, Commander, Quest said. I hope you don't think I meant that. But we have to keep on asking whether this is the best use of our resources. It's not as if the Romulans have welcomed our efforts with open arms now, is it?
You'd need to talk to Admiral Picard about that, said LaForge. I've not been out there. My job is to work on ways to build as many ships as possible as quickly as possible. The quicker we get those people to safety, the quicker we can get back to what we were doing before.
Quest looked down again at the production line and marveled. I think we all know that nothing will be how it was before.
Verity. As the months passed, Picard had found that arriving at each new threatened world brought a particular kind of intellectual and emotional struggle. This came from the fact that you had to keep your distance from the fear and despair with which you were confronted, while still resolutely maintaining the hope and the focus to alleviate the distress. He,
Coley and Rafi had talked about this balance often, and he sometimes received missives from Deanna Troy on the subject. For himself, work was the answer, being solidly and actively involved in this mission at every level. Hope alone was insufficient. If it did not translate into concrete, planned, and targeted action, then it was nothing more than fine words, and those meant nothing to these poor exiles. Above all, he knew, despair was not an option. The Starfleet uniform provided a significant shield that permitted one some aloofness, especially to Romulans, but that also signaled that help was here. Still, arriving at yet another world to be greeted by the sight of thousands upon thousands of frightened, dispossessed people was not easily borne. If Picard had been a different kind of man, he might have begun to relish the role of savior. But each face he saw, each child too dulled to be able to play, each old person with one hand pressed against a cheek as if that might offer some protection from the chaos all around, each of these humbled him. Sometimes, in the quiet of night, he would be reading through reports from all across this vast mission. Bowie, Tecotin, LaForge, Clancy, and he would find himself deeply and acutely daunted. The simple impossibility of the task that they had set for themselves, that he had set for himself, would be suddenly overwhelming. He felt beset by the requests from juniors, the questions of superiors, the demands of politicians and officials. The task was so great. Was he sufficient? In his heart, Picard had no answer to this, and suspected that only history would be able to judge what was being done during these days. He could only do what he believed was required. And he would put his doubts aside and find some equilibrium, remind himself that there was a world beyond those lost, sad souls. He would put down the reports and listen to some music. Brahms, perhaps. Ein deutsches Requiem. He would find consolation in the reminder that all flesh was as grass, that in the end, all our striving came to nothing, but that in that brief, aching, and vivid time that we call life, one must do all that was possible to protect, conserve, and nurture this phenomenon of life. Do all in one's power to help it flourish. Whether he was sufficient would be decided in time. For now, he would continue to bring relief to those in need. He brought the Verity to Inxtus with hope, as he arrived at all worlds that it had been his privilege to visit. The starship Nightingale had already been at Inxtus for a fortnight, and its captain, Jex Pecci, had been sending daily reports. All signs, Pecci reported, were positive. The population of Inxtus seemed less restive than other places they had visited, calmer somehow, as if trusting that the rescue would come through in time. The reports from Vashti, the Federation world in the Kiris sector that these people would soon be calling home, were, quite frankly, a joy to read. Clear plans had been laid out. They would have ample housing and facilities. And apparently, there was genuine excitement among the locals at welcoming the Romulans. Picard felt a sense of pride at these reports, sensing that the days of their apprenticeship were coming to an end, and that as they became more experienced, the mission would progress ever more smoothly. At Rafi's suggestion, and with Coley's blessing, Picard had suggested Bordson send a few news organizations to Vashti to report on the work being done. Still, none of this removed the fact that he would soon have yet another close encounter with the realities of frightened, poverty-stricken people.
"Admiral," said Rafi's voice on the comm, "we're now in orbit over Inxtus. We've received a communication from one of the settlements, Swordsoul Township. We are invited to meet someone named Zani."
He went down to the transporter room, where Rafi and Tajuth were waiting.
"Zani?" he said to Rafi. "Any idea who this might be?"
Rafi shook her head, nodded toward Tajuth, and put a finger to her lips.
"Yeah, I have a hunch about that," she said. "But let's keep it close for the moment."
Swordsoul Township, Inxtus. Inxtus surprised Picard immediately. Beaming down with Raffi and Tajuth, he found himself standing in a long and pleasant valley. A wide, slow river ran through. The fields on the gentle slopes were heavy with the harvest. The world's sun shone lovingly down. It was the very end of summer, in a temperate region, and the greens all around were on the cusp. Picard caught the first hints of red and yellow and brown in the leaves of the trees. In a few weeks, he thought, he might return here to see that most glorious sight, a full and rich autumn. The poignancy of this was almost unbearable. This harvest that he could see would not be taken in. This autumn would be the last for Inxtus. This world was damned, and not through any crime or sin, but through an event on a cosmic, stellar scale. This time, he thought, the fault was in the stars. Raffi, ever alert to the immediacy of her surroundings, checked her tricorder and said, "Numerous life signs. We must be on the edge of the township." Picard followed her, to Juth behind, wondering where the buildings were. They saw a huge tree ahead, multi-trunked, like a banyan tree, but with the individual trunks much wider and much farther apart. Here, he saw the first signs of civilization. Wooden decks, interlocked, lay around the trunks, and hanging from the branches and between the trunks were wide, sheer nets. Beyond other trunks, he saw other wooden decks, and behind the sheer nets, he saw the dark shapes of figures moving swiftly. He heard voices from amidst the trees, singing, speaking, and the sound of children playing. He understood these were the homes. Picard took a moment to orient himself. He had, over the past couple of years, become used to the claustrophobic nature of Romulan homes, the back doors and hidden passages that concealed even members of the same family from each other, as if the ties that would naturally bind each Romulan to the other must be disrupted, and a veil of secrecy thrown between each and every one of them. Doors and partitions and sound barriers, anything to prevent someone in one room knowing whether anyone was in the room next door. But this, here, this was the complete opposite. A house that lay open to all comers, that advertised its inhabitants, that let their voices carry on the air. How had this happened? What made them feel so secure to live in this way, when so many other Romulans lived with such a sense of palpable fear? As they came closer, they saw a very old Romulan woman sitting on a barrel, her back against the trunk of a tree, almost as gnarled as she was. She saw them, sat up, placing her hands firmly upon her knees, and called out,
"Zani, the humans are here, and they've been stupid enough to bring a damned Tuktzat with them."
A voice from behind the nets called out,
"I'm coming, Shay. Keep an eye on the Tuktzat."
Picard heard Tajuth mutter something that, from the plosives, was surely a curse. Picard's grasp of Romulan profanity had improved markedly in recent months, but some dialects were still a mystery to him, and Tajuth's voice, Picard noticed, had gone oddly nasal, as if he had fallen back on some childhood accent. Raffi, hearing, smiled, as if something had been confirmed to her.
"Well, Raffi," Picard said.
"Koat Milat," she murmured. "Well, I never thought I'd see this."
"Say that again, please, Commander."
She repeated the words, and he tried them on his tongue.
"Koat Milat."
"Not bad."
"Who are they exactly, Raffi?"
"They're nuns, JL. Warrior nuns."
Putting her hand on his arm, she moved him away from Tajuth.
"Guardians of truth. Traditional enemies of the Tal Shiar. Look at Tajuth. Red alert, a secret policeman's lot is not a happy one."
And indeed, Tajuth, usually so unreadable, was manifestly on guard, his hand resting upon his weapon.
"Told you he was Tal Shiar," said Raffi smugly. "They hate the Koat Milat,
and the feeling is mutual.
The old woman on her barrel was watching Tajuth with her lip curled. She looked so fierce that Picard was not entirely sure that he would bet against her if it came to blows.
What makes them such enemies, Ruffy?
Well, these things are always complicated, but as I understand it, there's a fundamental difference in ideology. The Kawat Milat follow what they call the way of absolute candor.
What does that mean?
One of the nets slung between the trees was pushed back, and a nun, younger than the one sitting on watch, came out, wiping flowered hands upon her skirts. Rafi said,
I guess we're about to find out.
Picard glanced back at Tajuth. No, not a happy man.
Absolute candor. That doesn't sound very Romulan.
And yet, here they are, said Rafi. It's a funny old universe, isn't it?
Warrior nuns. Romulan warrior nuns. You know, Rafi, I am grateful.
Grateful?
That the universe can still delight me.
The nun moved with speed and grace to greet her visitors. Standing in front of Picard, she held her hands together palm to palm and then opened them slowly and with great care as if they were a book or as if she was offering something. Her heart, perhaps.
Admiral Picard.
Zani?
He said uncertainly. She smiled.
Yes, I am Zani. Our house and our hearts are open to you, Picard.
Picard was suddenly and deeply moved. He had not realized until this moment how often, on arrival at these worlds, he had been greeted with anger, demands, resentment, hostility. It was not that he expected gratitude. He had not taken on this mission for rewards or thanks, but he had hoped for moments of amity. Now it was being offered. Here, on this quiet and lovely world, a Romulan had offered the hand of friendship. Carefully, he copied her gesture, pressed his hands together, opened them to her. He tried to think of some suitable words.
Jolan Tru, he said. We come in friendship and with open hands.
She looked delighted. She and Rafi exchanged the gesture, and Rafi said,
Kawat Milat, I am, well, wow.
Zani laughed, a full laugh straight from the depths of her belly. Then her eye fell on Tajuth.
You are welcome, Starfleet, despite the company you keep.
They did not get a chance to discuss this further. Something tiny but very fast-moving came rushing out of the house, pushing itself in the middle of their group. Picard, looking down, saw a boy, about 4 or 5 years of age had he been human, small, serious, and extremely grubby.
Are these the humans?
Said the child. He looked steadily at Picard.
They're ugly.
Thank you, said Picard gravely.
Absolute candor, Rafi reminded him.
I believe we were both included in that assessment, Rafi.
Awkwardly, Picard bent down on one knee.
Well, young man, he said, I am Admiral Jean-Luc Picard. And who are you?
Elnor,
said the boy.
I wanted a present.
Rafi laughed. Picard panicked.
Do you like books?
Wow, J.L., said Rafi. You're a natural.
She glanced at Zani.
That was a lie. Sorry.
Zani nodded to show she understood the curious human tendency towards sarcasm. The boy stared at Picard.
Yes,
he said.
I like books.
He shoved his filthy little hand into Picard's and began to pull him toward the house.
You can come and read to me.
Picard glanced over his shoulder to Zani, who said,
Yes, follow Elnor. He knows the way.
She looked back at Tajuth.
Your Tal Shiar friend can come, too, if he's feeling brave.
They were welcomed into the house beneath the trees. There were women everywhere, old and young, and girls, too, some wearing the same robes as the older women, but in a paler shade of blue.
postulants, Picard thought, or novices, if the Kawat Milat had such gradations. They did not strike him as the kind of people that would trouble themselves with such hierarchies. The convent, for such he saw now was the nature of the place, was a hive of activity, and while nobody seemed to be issuing orders, everyone seemed clear on the tasks that needed to be done. The new arrivals sparked considerable curiosity, and the presence of Tajuth attracted considerable amusement.
"Is he really here for supper?"
"Don't tell him, sister, but he is supper." Picard suppressed a smile. Rafi was less diplomatic. The expression on her face mirrored what Picard was feeling. Delight that this place existed. Amazement that it was so ineffably, so completely Romulan. After so many months of navigating the choppy waters of Romulan sensibilities and secrecies, the place was like a glass of cool, clear water. Zani took them through into a common area. The space was clearly being made for people ready to eat together. At one end, a group of 5 women were putting away their weaving. Others were pulling back net curtains to open the area up farther. As Picard watched, younger girls began to carry through low, round tables and set them around the room. 8 tables altogether set around to form another circle. Circles upon circles. Other women dashed around, setting the tables with plates and dishes and cutlery and small pots filled with tiny, bright, sweet-scented flowers. From beyond the far end of the area, Picard caught the tantalizing smell of cooking. The kitchen, he guessed. He heard voices, busy and chattering. Do the humans eat this kind of thing? The laughter of women. Picard followed Zani as she led him around the tables. The boy's hand was still shoved stickily into his. He realized now that he had seen no other men, only himself and Tajuth, who was still attracting attention and the odd hoot of derision, and the child, Elnor. Were there no men here at all? How had the boy ended up among them? Was it permitted in some way? They came to the table closest to the kitchen space. There were no chairs. Picard glanced at Rafi, who shrugged.
Don't ask me, she murmured. I thought they were a legend until about 30 minutes ago.
I'd hate to offend, he murmured back.
I kind of get the feeling they'd tell you straight out if you did that.
The boy had started tugging Zani's hand.
Can I stay up? He said.
It's getting late, said Zani. Look.
She pointed through the curtains, now tinted with a red glow.
The sun is setting.
I want to look at the humans, said Elnor firmly.
There was no whining or pleading. He simply stated this as a fact.
I want to eat supper with you.
But you are very small, said Zani, and that means that you need more sleep. Also, you are happier in the mornings if you go to bed early. You are not pleasant company when you stay up late.
The boy frowned. This assessment clearly had the unmistakable ring of truth.
If I stay up late tonight, he said, I promise to go to bed earlier tomorrow.
Zani reached over to tuck a strand of the boy's long, dark hair behind his ear.
Promises are prisons, Elnor, she chided him. Do not take the risk of walking blindly into a lie.
But I want to stay up, he said again.
He looked at Picard.
I think you should tell her I can stay up.
Picard was aware of Rafi behind him, enjoying this, damn her. She was a mother. She had probably suffered through this battle numerous times and was enjoying being a bystander for once. I think, he said to the boy, that you should obey Zani.
Oh, no, said Zani quickly. I would never require obedience from anyone.
Then he looked at Zani for guidance, not wishing to interfere with her way of bringing up the child, but she was not forthcoming. He thought for a moment. Compromise, he thought. That was what he would want to teach a child. How to negotiate. How to compromise. I think that you should stay for a little while, and then go.
But I want to stay until everyone else goes to bed.
And yet Zani wants you to go earlier. so let us find a way that will make both you and Zani happy. You said that you liked books.
Yes, said Elnor with some suspicion.
If you go to bed when Zani asks, I will read something to you. A human story.
Story?
A fiction. A tale. Something made up.
A lie?
The boy looked puzzled.
No, said Picard gently. A human way of telling certain truths.
Elnor thought for a while.
Very well, he said. We will eat together, and when Zani says so, I will go to bed, and you will read something to me.
Elnor sat down on the floor. He reached up to tug at Picard's sleeve until Picard sat down next to him. Zani took her place at Picard's other side. Raffi next to her. Zani indicated to Tajuth to take his place opposite her.
Sit there, she said, where I can see you.
Tajuth stiffly did as he was asked. He did not look happy. He looked even less happy when the old woman who had been keeping watch for their arrival came and sat down next to him.
There you are, Tokzat. Now behave yourself. I don't want my supper spoiled.
Others were beginning to take their places. Soon the hall was full of women. And then the food came. A thick and spicy stew that reminded Picard of the kind of lamb dish one might eat somewhere in the Mediterranean, accompanied by another made from pulses that he thought was very like a doll. There were huge round flatbreads, cut into triangles. Prejean, Zani called them. Many of the women did not bother with spoons or forks, and simply dug in with the bread, spooning up the food. Raffi did the same thing, eating with obvious pleasure. Tajuth picked at pieces of bread and drank only water. Picard was offered and took a pale yellow wine that he was sure his family would have been proud to produce. Raffi accepted cup after cup. Zani asked perceptive questions about the mission, and Picard found himself answering frankly and openly. He talked in some detail about the multiple frustrations of juggling both the expectations of his superiors and of trying to navigate the conflicting messages that came from Romulan officials.
A little more frankness all around would do no harm, she said, and he agreed.
The plates were gathered up and taken out, and then dessert came.
Ah, said Zani, a gleam in her eye. Have you ever tried Hanifak before, Admiral?
I'm not sure I know what it is, he said.
A plate was set down in the middle of the table, piled high with candies. Each was formed into a small square, and there were many different colors. The effect was bright and cheerful. Picard reached to take one, pressing it gently between thumb and forefinger. It felt slightly soft, like marzipan. Zani took one, popped it into her mouth.
So sweet, she said. I shall miss this.
Picard had found, over the long months of this mission, that there were simple moments that pierced him suddenly, as if he had been stabbed. A woman eating a favorite treat, not knowing whether she would be able to find them again in the place where she was going. Such losses, he thought, which seemed so small, the comforts and pleasures of life. These would be the hardest to replicate. They might never be replaced. He put the Hanifak into his mouth. She was right. It was so very sweet. Picard made sure Elnor got to bed, as he promised, and recited to him some of the Little Prince that he remembered. The tale of a lost and lonely little boy who saw things differently from those around him, finding a home in the stars. Picard had loved it as a child and asked his mother to read it to him many times. He watched as Elnor's eyes grew heavy, the small fist on the pillow slackening and releasing, sleep taking him. He stopped and, very carefully, touched the child's brow as if to bestow a blessing. Then he went back to the common room. Tajuth had gone back to the ship. Raffi was sitting with Shay and a few of her cronies, playing a card game that looked both complicated and merciless. He watched for a while, and then went in search of Zani.
He found her sitting on a bench outside, close to the tree trunk, looking out across their lands. It was long past sunset. The sky was inky, and a breeze was lifting, sending the nets all around drifting. Lamps were lit, great round lamps that showed pathways through the valley.